going through the lockdown like everybody else, but we're making the best of it, aren't we?
Well, I can hear the birds there. You're in the outdoors, aren't you?
Oh, it's a lovely day, but don't worry, I am social distancing. There's no one close by, don't worry.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. Get involved with the debate by tweeting at Blue Moon Podcast and check out exclusive interviews on bluemoonpodcast.com. It's your club and this is your show.
These days, Manchester City are synonymous with entertaining football. If you want to watch great goals and stylish play, then you can't go wrong with a Pep Guardiola team. For years, though, that wasn't always the case at City. There have been good spells, of course, but there have also been seasons where football was difficult to watch. In the early days of the Premier League, though, City became one of the division's great entertainers. They weren't a successful team by any of the usual measures, but when Brian Houghton's time at Main Road dugout was over, many supporters look back at two very erratic but very entertaining campaigns. Welcome to this week's Blue Moon Podcast, where we're travelling back to the 1993-94 and 1994-95 seasons to reflect on Houghton's time at City. I'm your host, David Mooney, and for this one, I'm joined by Goal.com's Jonathan Smith.
How you doing?
I'm not too bad. Are you well?
Good, good. Yeah, erratic and entertaining. That sounds like a good way to sell this. That's how I remember it, yeah.
It is. I mean, let's dive straight in there, because Brian Houghton took charge of City four games into the 93-94 season. So we're starting off by going back to around about August 1993. Just to kind of give a flavour, the music has worked really well in these previous seasons, taking us back to that time. So here's a selection of things that were in the charts back then. Make of that, John?
I don't have any fond memories of that music at all. It certainly wasn't what I was listening to. I was very much in my late Manchester grunge era phase then.
Really? Because I was about 93. I'd have been about 6 years old at that time. And I know it was Freddie Mercury we finished on there, not Queen, but I fucking loved Queen. I'm not going to lie. I knew the words to pretty much every Queen song and I was 6 years old. It's fantastic.
I actually saw Queen at Main Road.
Did you?
Yes. It was my first concert I ever went to.
When did they play Main Road? I didn't know they played.
Probably about 87 or something like that. I think it was after Live Aid. A couple of years after Live Aid.
Wow.
Were they good? By Status Quo.
Was it good? Not to your taste.
Probably, but I would never go there. Go and see Queen there. Well, obviously not.
Yeah, well, not now, yeah. Right, so City began the 93-94 season with Peter Reid in charge, but it was clear from behind the scenes that all was not well. Peter Swales brought in John Maddock, a former newspaper journalist, as general manager, and he said that he had the power to hire and fire at the club. The manager at the time was Peter Reid. Here's what he told us back in 2013.
I had problems with the chairman about... I think he went into Manchester Evening News, if you look back, and said he had £6 million to spend and it wasn't forthcoming. So I obviously, as a young manager and a bit hot-headed, wasn't happy with that. And there was unrest, yeah, without a doubt.
How did it affect you to see John Maddock come in?
Well, I wasn't overly keen on the situation. And we had a couple of discussions about football, which I didn't agree with him on. And it made me feelings known, and he asked me to get rid of me number two, and I said, well, am I the manager or you? So that was a bit of discontent, and I let me feel his known, and I was gone after four games.
I was going to say, the phrase that was used was the power to hire and fire.
Well, that's God rest his soul, Mr. Swales is near now, so that's one to ask him. But I certainly got fired.
Now then, there was also rumours of falling outs between players and Sam Ellis. I mean, what was going on?
I think that was instigated through the press by some... I had rucks with play. If there's not an argument at a football club, I'd say, well, you're not doing it right. Or any workplace. So, rubbish as usual.
Did you get the impression that the sack was on its way?
Yeah. Yeah, because some of the discussions me and the chairman had weren't very amicable, let's put it that way.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
Peter Reid speaking to the podcast there. John, what did you make of the sacking of Reid?
I think that City were on the way down a little bit. If you put it into the context of when Howard Kendall had taken over, he really steadied the ship. In fact, he did more than that. He obviously took them up to fifth place, brought in a lot of ex-Everton players who were possibly past their best. But, you know, they did a job and they responded to a new environment, really. People like Alan Harper, who wasn't great at Everton. I thought he had a couple of good seasons at City. Adrian Heath, Peter Reid, Neil Poynton. A couple of players like that. So it steadied the ship. And then, obviously, Kendall decided to go back to Goodison Park. Peter Reid gets the job. And from my point of view, and I don't know whether City fans agree who remember that side, but it felt like they were going backwards and that team was getting old. And it wasn't being changed quickly enough. That they were still relying on some of those older players when they really needed to freshen it up a bit smarter. They brought in some new players, but there was still a problem with that squad. And also the style of play as well. It was a little bit long ball, which is okay when you're winning, which they were a lot of the time. They had those two fifth-place finishes on the trot, but they weren't winning quite as often as they had been.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was about 5-6 years old at the time, so I don't really remember not even the style of play or how the seasons were going. I just remember kind of the odd trip to Main Road with my mum and dad. But looking back, I mean, they finished ninth in the first Premier League season, fifth the two seasons before that. I mean, they finished above United at that stage as well, so they were still, I'd say, surely a fairly successful English side.
Yeah. I think you go back to that the season they finished fifth under Peter Reid. I can't remember off the top of my head, but my memory seems to suggest that it was fifth, but it could one defeat and it could have been ninth. It was one of those really tight finishes, and they won the last game of the season and ended up finishing fifth. I might be getting mixed, but it wasn't. You know, they weren't. It's not like now where you would say these are the five best teams in England or six best teams in England. There was a couple of good teams, and then the rest were all in the mix.
Yeah, when Swales sacked Reid, they had 1 point from the first four games of 93-94. It was suddenly Swales. He'd been chairman for 20 years. He was searching for his 11th manager. How were the fans feeling about all that?
Yeah, I just think it was, like I say, I thought it was time maybe to look for something fresh. But I mean, City had been guilty, particularly during the 80s and the early 90s, of just ditching managers quickly and looking for a quick fix. I mean, certainly I wouldn't necessarily disagree with too many of those sackings. You know, certainly go back to John Bond, and then Billy McNeil decided to leave himself, and then the rest made it very difficult for them to justify staying. You know, Machin and then Kendall left. He decided to leave, and it was probably, I think, the right decision. That he felt like Reid had sort of lost a way of taking the club forward. I mean, it was a decent squad in some areas. You had players like Niall Quinn, Keith Curl, David White, who were really good players. Tony Coton was a good keeper. and he had half a dozen good, you know, good First Division players. I think in the like Ian Brightwell and Mike Sheeran. But then there was some older players who were getting, you know, who weren't as effective and were needed replacing. And there was a bit of a feeling that perhaps they'd gone as far as they could under Reid and just needed
something fresh
idea. Yeah.
Well, at the time, City were looking at Steve Coppell, Joe Royal, Rodney Marsh, Terry Venables as the new boss. All names that fans were aware of. They ended up with Brian Houghton from Oxford. So, I mean, were you expecting a bigger name at that time?
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember listening to Piccadilly Radio and either Swales or Maddock came on and said, we're not going to say who it is, but it's definitely someone the fans are going to get very excited about. And you thought, oh, right, okay, then. That's promising. And then... Yeah, I mean, I don't remember the names that were in the frame too much. I mean, Coppell at the time was an exciting manager with Palace, but I think there was still a bit of reticence because of his United links.
There still was when he got the job years later, wasn't there? So.
Yeah, and then someone like Joe Royal, I think he decided to stay to Oldham, and I think people... We would have really liked Joe, but I think it says everything about Joe Royal that no one held it against him that he decided to stay at Oldham. I think at the time that Oldham were probably a side that were going places, and
yeah.
It was, you know, they really did everything they could to keep him, and I don't think it was the worst thing. I think it was understandable that he stayed, but as for Rodney Marsh, I don't remember his name being in the frame, but I think that would have been a disaster.
So now, be honest, John, were you one of those who was asking Brian who?
Yeah, exactly that. Like I say, after hearing what was said about who the next manager was going to be, it was hugely underwhelming. You know, it was more common then for a manager to come from a lower league club and into the top division, but he wasn't even like he was tearing up trees at Oxford. He was, you know, Oxford weren't on people's radars in terms of being one of the best lower league teams or playing attractive football. It was just, they were the Oxford that I've known all my life. Just at 18.
Just existed, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we spoke to Brian Houghton back in 2012 on the podcast. Here's what he said about getting the job at Main Road.
When I got the opportunity to take the job, and I took it on the Friday as they were playing Coventry City on the Friday night, you can't turn jobs like that down. And I thought I'd earned my stripes, to be fair. You know, I'd had 5 years at Hull City with one promotion, managing the championship for four there. Went to Oxford, managing the championship for nearly five there. So 10 years managing the championship, you know. So a lot of people obviously thought at the time, you know, that I probably wasn't big enough name to go in there. But I didn't feel that way. So I set out to enjoy it as much as I could, you know. And then I think I won them round eventually with the football that I played and really enjoyed my time there.
I was going to ask, how did it feel to hear fans asking things like Brian who?
It's a minority, isn't it? You know, it's generally a minority. Brian who, when I'd played there and I'd managed there. So I took that with a pinch of salt, and I think that's how the press perceived it, really. But you have to believe in your own ability, and I did. And you know, by the time I left, I think people had realised that I had brought some good players in, I had played some good football, and that it was 2 years of enjoyment on my part. I just set out to enjoy it.
Check out exclusive City interviews on our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
So that was Brian Houghton speaking to us, goodness me, almost a decade ago on the podcast. He wanted an attacking style of play, and in that first season he let striker David White go, but brought in the likes of Paul Walsh, Nicky Summerby and Uwe Rosler. How much work do you think that squad needed at that time, John? You were already saying that it was quite aging. Was it the refresh that it needed?
Yeah, it was. I think if I remember it as from a fan's point of view, it felt like it had all gone a bit stale, and it needed a sort of new look to it, which is certainly what he did. You know, getting rid of David White was an uncomfortable decision because he was a homegrown player, but he looked like he wasn't as great as he had been. Rick Holden was another one who went out. He'd never worked. So you're getting rid of the two wingers there who hadn't been working in that last season under Reid, and then he brought in sort of the likes, you know, just brought in a bit of attacking flair. Beagrie from Everton, Walsh, Nicky Summerby, and you know, suddenly there's a bit of excitement and a bit of a change about the way they were playing. It's a bit more fluent, a bit more flamboyant, I suppose.
Did you know much about the players that were coming in at the time? Because I mean, this we always talk about the 90s as when you talk about players coming in from abroad, not knowing who they are because you can't just go on YouTube and find out. So I'm guessing Rosley you didn't know anything about, but like a lot of these transfers have come from elsewhere in England. So I mean, was there excitement at what he was building?
I don't think they were massive signings in the likes of, you know, a couple of years before Keith Curl and Terry Phelan had arrived for big money. So you're expecting a lot from them. You know, Paul Walsh has been a good player. He'd been a great player as a young when he first broke out at Luton and then at Liverpool. And I don't know, he just lost his way slightly and he'd gone to various places. So it was always a bit of a gamble. Peter Beagrie was, you know, was one of the most skillful players I've ever seen. But his decision-making was the problem because he just... And I don't think that changed when he came to City. But, I mean, you know, there was no one who could dummy, he could fake and cut inside but then he'd go out, dummy. And he just wanted to beat a player three or four times. And it was brilliant. He was brilliant for Stoke and he was brilliant for Everton. But he's just, it had become a frustration, I think, for Everton. I don't think there were moments when he was frustrating at City, but I think he was better at City and better at his decision making.
Yeah. Well, here's Brian Houghton again talking about getting those players in.
I knew Man City fans loved attacking football with the two wide players, and that's what I did in bringing Peter Beagrie and Nicky Summerby in, bringing Uwe Rosler in, Paul Walsh in. So mainly they were strikers that I brought in, you know, which the club needed. Niall Quinn had an awful knee injury, you know, with his cruciate ligament. I sold David White and Mike Sherin. So I pull those players in. Uwe was a revelation for £350,000. I mean, he was just incredible. And, you know, after I'd left, and whilst I was there, as it happens, to hear them singing his name and the way they did. And all the fans love Walshy. The players love Walshy because he was good in the dressing room. But he was also an outstanding footballer. He scored goals, he worked hard, he was good in the dressing room. And so were they all. Nicky played his part by being probably the least offensive of the four, because he did his duties coming back to make the three with Gary Flitcroft and Steve Lomas. Peter Beagrie, out-and-out winger again. Fantastic ability, fantastic footballer, and fantastic person again, good in the dressing room. So we had a good spirit about us, you know, and I thought towards the end, when I realised it was coming, knew it was probably coming, that I thought two or three players, we could have been a really outstanding side, because I had the likes of Tony Coton and Keith Curl and people like that that I inherited, Gary Flitcroft, Steve Lomas. I mean, Steve was, that was the first thing I ever had to do. I don't know many people knew about this story, that one of the first phone calls I got was from Preston North End, ironically, about doing a swap for Steve Lomas and one of their players, and I was paying 100 grand. And I said, can I get this right, that I'm giving you 100 grand and Steve Lomas, one of your players? So I turned that down, obviously, and then Steve got in the side, and him and Gary Flitcroft were tremendous together.
Of the players that you brought in, did you ever think that any of them were a gamble? Do you think, snapping up Uwe Rosler, like you mentioned, do you think that was a gamble for you, or did you know what you were getting?
It was a lucky one, really, because an agent just rang me to see what I wanted, and Niall had just had a cruciate knee operation. So we were short of strikers, and I said, yeah, I'm looking for a striker. He said, I've got an East German international. Never heard of Uwe Rosler. I speak to him almost every week now. And He said you can have him on trial. So we got him on trial, put him in the reserve game on the Tuesday night. He scored. I got him off at half time and I put him in the team at QPR on a Saturday. And he made the goal, I think, if I'm right, for Walshy. So he proved that to be a very, very good player. Every transfer is a gamble. And every millions you spend is a gamble because some come off, some don't come off. So for 350 grand, it wasn't much of a gamble, wasn't it? It wasn't like 35 million, you know, that you're gambling. But he was a fantastic... They were those players that I had at the time. They had a great team spirit about them, you know. And I like that. I like characters. I don't want people to be subservient and, you know, listen and do everything you tell them to do. You want players with a spark and a bit of communication and devilment about them at times, you know, and those players certainly did. TC was a great character. Curley, captain, was a character. Niall was a great character around the dressing room. They were brilliant to work with.
You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast. Facebook.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Now, one of the new players that fans quickly took to was Uwe Rosler. He was the first German player to score in the Premier League, and in the years since the Second World War, few Germans had made their careers in English football. Here's what he said to the podcast in 2013 about joining City.
I couldn't communicate much because my English was non-existent. And I'm driven very much on communication. So it was very difficult for me to communicate, but the teammates I had around me, all credit to them, they took a lot of effort to integrate me. And sometimes I felt it was very difficult to integrate a person who can't speak. So, but they put a lot of effort in. The manager put also a lot of effort in to show me on the tactic board and try to communicate. And over time, I picked up quite quick. Maybe not the most sophisticated English, but around Moss Side, so Moss Side English. And no, I think obviously helped when Paul Walsh, Peter Beagrie, I, and Stefan Karl came in. The results improved, and the players around me made it easy for me to settle, and the relationship with the manager went from strength to strength. I also said the big part was also Francis Lee, just appointed as a new chairman. I think I was his first signing, and his son Gary, who is now one of my best friends in England, really, really looked after me and helped me in the first part. And I think that all there was a lot of people who helped me on the road to settle very quick in this football club.
For a pledge of $2 a month, you can hear our weekly bonus show on a wide range of City topics. There's more details on patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
So, John, one of the first big players of the Houghton era to talk about is Uwe Rosler. What did you know about him at the time when he came in? What were your impressions of him?
Nothing. I didn't know anything about him. There was a lot less known about European players then. City had a few. They were starting to become more regular, but they weren't. They certainly weren't. Sort of, you know, I don't remember City signing an international, with perhaps the exception of Ingebrigtsen, who was, you know, Norway weren't a great team then. So they'd signed a couple of players from, I think it's Stefan Karl was German. Groenendijk was Dutch, Vonk was Dutch, but they weren't anywhere near the national teams.
Should also say at this point as well, this was a time when there were rules in place to say you could only have a certain number of foreign players in the team.
Yeah, yeah. So, but the impression was that he wasn't, you know, that Germany team around then was a very, very good team, and Rosler was nowhere near the national team. So you knew you weren't. You weren't expecting a top player, but on top of that, he was an East German, which, you know, wasn't too long after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and, you know, East German football in the years before was a long, long way behind West German football. So, yeah, I think it was more hope than expectation when he arrived.
Houghton says that the fans took to him quickly. Was that true?
I don't think they took to him as quickly as perhaps hindsight would suggest, because he struggled at first. He didn't. I don't think he scored in his first few games, and I think people liked his work rate. He worked very, very hard, very honest. You know, he gave everything, chased out every lost cause, and was determined. And he had a good relationship with the fans. That seemed to come naturally to him, that he would just clap the fans and things like that, and appreciate every when they appreciated him. So I think that was always a good start. But I'm not sure that anyone thought, you know, this is a player that the fans are going to absolutely love.
Yeah. What was he good at? What did he offer City that they hadn't had? Because Horton says he wanted a striker, and Rosler came in at the right time, sort of thing.
I think they needed a little bit more mobility after the Quinn and White years. You know, I love Niall Quinn. He was a great player, and is often written off, you know, as just a target man. He didn't have any pace. He had a lot more skill than people give him credit for, but he didn't have any pace. White had a lot of pace, but, you know, sometimes his decision making wasn't great. Whereas Rosler was a bit more of an all-rounder. You know, he could play with the ball at his feet, he could pass, he could work hard, he could score goals. Like I say, he wasn't... Those first few games, you just thought, yeah, he's okay. But gradually, things started to change. And then at the end of that season, he started to find his scoring boots. And once one got in, he went on a bit of a run of scoring goals. And suddenly, you know, he thought, actually, there's got a bit of a play here.
Yeah, well, let's hear from him again. He would go on to form one of the most memorable City strike partnerships with Paul Walsh, another Brian Horton signing. Here's what Rosler told us about linking up with his fellow striker.
I believe very much in working on a training ground and working with players and try to build relation between the strikers and the wingers and the midfielders. But with Paul, it was totally opposite. With Paul, it was just to put two strangers on the field, and after two or three games, they certainly try to function, and we have never really trained on. There was chemistry more or less from the first moment. We needed some time to adapt, but we was just in our way of play different, and we accomplished each other very well. And normally, when you have a strike partnership, it's always one who suffer, one who's working very hard, and another one who put the ball in the net. But in our case, both of us, we got the credit in terms of goals. Paul had one of his best years. I think he scored 16, 17, 18 goals. I scored in the following year 23. So we both got the rewards for the hard work we was putting in, and I felt we really liked to play with each other, and we really appreciated each other very much.
And with Peter Beagrie and Nicky Summerby on the wings,
yes.
Do you feel that was kind of like the best system for you as an individual?
I always, main road was a big pitch. I felt the movement Paul and I had up front, there was a lot of gaps. We exploited them, and obviously that gave also the wingers a lot of space to do their trickery, especially Peter Beagrie, who was an excellent dribbler, could cross from the inside, from the outside, very accurate with both feet. Nicky Summerby was a more a direct one, who shifted the ball quickly like David Beckham and bended around the defender. And don't forget, Niall Quinn, after his absence with the injury, Niall Quinn came in, and at some point we played with three strikers up front, totally offensive football. And I think we had so many different options to attack, a lot of energy in the centre midfield with Stevie Loomis and Gary Flitcroft, Fitzroy Simpson. So there was a lot of positive offensive football at the time, and a lot of our supporters still remember that period because of the amount of goals and the fluent attacking football we played.
You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
Was it that moment where those two hit it off, John, that really kicked that Horton team into gear, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think Niall Quinn had a serious injury and he was out for a while, and so they were sort of slightly forced into playing Rosler and Walsh, and It just was the confidence just seemed to grow between the two of them. And you know, Walsh was getting, you know, like I say, Walsh was always had been a great player, and he was, you know, he was really finding that form, that a real sort of rejuvenation of his, and his skill and his energy, he looked like he was really enjoying himself. And with each passing game, Rosler seemed to grow in confidence and was being talked about as one of the best strikers in the Premier League. He was just scoring on a regular basis. He had a great relationship with the club that was growing all the time. I'm not sure you'd probably do it now, but there was that T-shirt, the Rosler's granddad bombed Old Trafford, which...
Didn't that nearly cause a diplomatic incident at one stage? Well,
I don't think you'd do it now, but it was a bit of a joke. But he was just... Uwe just seemed to understand what it was, what the City fans wanted from him, and did it, gave it to them, worked hard, gave everything, enjoyed playing, wearing the City shirt, and it was, it all worked out really well.
Why do you think it did? Was it just how... Were all these components just in the right place at the right time? Because we're going to come on... Like, City made the pitch as big as they could. They had Peter Beagrey one side, Nicky Summerby on the other, just stretching the game all the time. Did that just work? Why did that just work so well?
Yeah, probably they did have a bit more width. But I think Horton's philosophy was to try and win every game. Which was great when it paid off. But I think you also have to remember that there were some very, very painful defeats during his time there. They lost 5-0 at Old Trafford, which is still the worst defeat I can remember against United. The worst match I can remember going to watch City was the most painful, certainly, was the quarter-final League Cup defeat at Crystal Palace, where they lost 4-0 and were absolutely terrible. And then that was a hard defeat to take, because they were awful in the first half, absolutely terrible, and somehow it was 0-0 at half time. And you just thought, well,
they've got away with it, sort of thing. Yeah,
they won't be as bad in the second half, and they were even worse and lost 4-0. So. Yeah, as brilliant as it was to go out attacking, sometimes it was very, very painful.
We've talked a bit about Peter Beagrey. I think fans remember him quite well, don't they?
I would say so. Yeah.
Why not Nicky Summerby then?
The easy answer is that he wasn't as good as Beagrey. That's a simple answer. The thing was, when Nicky Summerby arrived, everybody really wanted it to be a success, particularly the older City fans. Who loved Mike, loved everything about Mike, still do. And they really wanted Nicky to be Mike Mark II. And I mean, I never saw Mike Summerby play, but he wasn't quite as good. And sometimes, you know, he had good games, don't get me wrong. You know, he has made some big contributions. And people did like him, but sometimes he just had bad games. And occasionally, he was one of those players who looked like he was being lazy, and that's not necessarily the way he was playing the game. I don't know if Chris Waddle was one like that, who always looked like he was lazy, but he gave everything. And Summerby was a bit like that. He looked sometimes like he didn't care, which I'm sure he did.
Yeah, it was perhaps a tough move for him, given that he played as a right-sided winger, and that's where his dad Mike had made his name in the iconic City team of the 60s. Here's what he told us way back in 2010 about making the move to Main Road.
With Dad and the connections with Dad, we used to come all the time to Main Road, what it was at the time. You know, used to love that, used to go to the Derby games and all that, and there was only one choice, and we used to have a couple of other clubs interested. I had Celtic, Villa, Middlesbrough, Brian Robson was there, and Man City, and there was only one choice for me. Manchester City.
Did you feel any extra pressure going there because of how your dad had played in the team?
No, people ask me, you know, what's it like, obviously having a famous dad. I don't know any different. My dad's my dad at the end of the day, and that's what it is. But going there, it was for me. I wanted to be a better player than Dad. I wasn't, but I wanted to be a better player than him, and that was, you know, if I lived my life again, I'd still do it. And the City fans gave me a good crack at it. You know, don't get me wrong. I knew what Dad was all about, but it never made any difference at all for me. Why wouldn't you? You know, I wanted to play Manchester derbies. you know, and obviously some of the players that were there at the time to run the dressing room was Niall Quinn, Nuve Rosler, Gary Flitcroft, Keith Curl, Terry Field, and all top players, Tony Cohen, all top players. So for me, there was never in any question at all.
Get involved with the debate on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
So, John, I want to talk about some standout matches in Horton's time at City, notably the Spurs and Blackburn games. Horton's two seasons at City were up and down. They finished in the lower half of the Premier League each time, 16th and 17th. We should say that this was a 22-team league then, not a 20-team league. And they did suffer some heavy defeats, like you said, but they also played in some big, impressive wins as well. The one that I think a lot of people will say stands out is that 5-2 win over Spurs in Horton's second season, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say that is the game to remember Brian Horton by in his time at City. I mean, it was a fantastic day, fantastic game. But I think if you put it into the context of the time, that was a really good Spurs team. You know, Jurgen Klinsmann was playing up front that day with Teddy Sheringham. There was a lot of excitement about that Tottenham team. There was a lot of media buzz about them, so they were. They were starting to drop off a little bit after a good start, but that was a good team. Popescu was playing for them as well, a couple of other names. So, you know, they came to Main Road as a big side, and City absolutely trounced them that day. And in just a magical display of football, it was just a lot of fun that day. And the way that City played, they was just brilliant. They just seemed faster, just sharper all over the pitch. You know, just the movement, the passing, everything was better. Beating players one on one. You know, Walsh was right at it. Beague was at it. It was just fantastic.
Even now, given what you've seen Guardiola's City do and how they've played in the Premier League in the last couple of years, does it still feel like it's up there as one of City's best ever performances? Because you have to take context into consideration as well for that.
I think if you put it into the context of, you know, watching City at Main Road for a long time and then getting a performance like that, that's what made it memorable. You know, if you take this season and beating Watford 8-0, you know, City were absolutely fantastic that day, destroyed Watford, pulled them apart. You know, they could have scored 15 goals, so. And that is not even a memorable game, is it really, in the Pep era? So in the context of, is it one of the greatest performances I've ever seen? No. Is it one of the most memorable? Yeah.
Right. Well, let's have a listen to the incidents from that game. Here's the match of the day commentary from John Motson.
Quinn waiting. It's Walsh! Goal! Paul Walsh scores against his old club. And the City fans salute another quick strike by the top scorer, played in first of all towards Quinn. It ran loose, and look at the way Walsh touched that in. Klinsmann, oh, he's in here. Oh, penalty, is it? Yes, got to be. The crowd think Klinsmann dived. City fans, that is. And Dumitrescu takes the penalty with some aplomb. Just inside him is Lomas. Walsh and Quinn are in the middle. Walsh! Quinn! Niall Quinn makes it 2-1. And the direct style of City here pays off. It's Summerby's cross. Walsh comes in first. Watch the save by Walker. Did his best. But Niall Quinn is on hand. And a really good cross by Nicky Summerby. A good header by Walsh. And a great follow-up by Quinn. Oh, look at that from Beagle. That's real wing play. Vintage stuff. Quinn. Walsh is in the centre waiting. Walsh! There's no other word for it. And it's still going to be Klinsmann. Back heel to Dumitrescu. Deflection. Goal! Spurs have got one back in the first minute of the second half. And the overseas connection works again. Oh, it's there! It's Lomas. Number four. And again from across. So sprightly. What a good run by Paul Walsh. He's still there. Oh, and yes, Flitcroft! wonderfully well made by Walsh and put away cleanly by Gary Flitcroft, who congratulates the man who made it possible. Just look at this, taking them all on, two or three of them in his wake. I thought he was going to shoot there for a minute, so did Tottenham. He checked back in, squared it, and Gary Flitcroft makes it 5-2 to City with about 10 minutes to go.
So alongside that game, another fans often remember is one that nearly helped rivals Manchester United win the title. City went to Ewood Park in April 1995 as Blackburn were trying to get over the line ahead of United for the title. And City went there and won 3-2. Here's Brian Horton talking about both of those games.
We had some great performances still at the end of the season, the Blackburn away 3-2. That was towards the end, that was a great... We nearly stopped Blackburn winning the league. And some of our fans didn't want us to do that because they didn't want Man United to win the league. So, although our fans celebrated that night, I've still got it on tape, or disc, whatever you call them, and DVD, and the Tottenham game. John Motson, the Tottenham game, and everybody, I wish I had a pound for every supporter of Manchester City that said, I remember that game against Tottenham, 5-2. There, Petrescu, Dumitrescu, Nicky Barmby, Sheringham. What a side they had, Klinsmann. What a side we beat them 5-2. My side that day was absolutely awesome. John Motson said to me, it's one of the best games he's ever commentated on. Now, that takes some saying. That takes some doing. And it could have been 10-8 to us. It could have been anything. But it was a great game of football. And as long as you win, and I think I got that off David Pleat more than some of my other managers, that no matter what you won by, as long as you won, and it was entertaining, and it was a joy to watch, then it didn't matter. So some games you come off and you've drawn 0-0 or won 1-0 and it's not been a great game. You haven't really, really enjoyed it yourself, because you are meant to enjoy football. And I know the City fans now are enjoying watching Man City play at this present time, and I'm delighted, you know. So that's what I set out to do, and I think I achieved it.
So kind of you score five, we'll score six attitude.
Absolutely. And the players at that time were scoring lots of goals. It would be Everton 4-0. There's games I can look back on that thought tremendous games of football, which I knew the Man City fans wanted.
Please give us your backing. patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
What do you remember of that Ewood Park game, John?
Not a lot, to be honest. I had to refresh myself watching it on YouTube.
I sat down to watch it, and you know what? I was captivated by it all.
But it did start to come back quite quickly when I started watching it. And the thing, a couple of things that came back quickly were that was a really good Blackburn team. You know, there was some of those names in that side. That's a really strong team, the City B. And also, I do remember, it was just a matter of time in the second half. It was just so much better. City completely deserved it. They battered them in the second half and deserved to win.
Did you? Were you worried at that time about, oh God, we've just handed United the title?
I don't recall that. I mean, I thought it was a couple of years before, been through it with Leeds when they won the title and City had beaten them 4-0 towards the end of the season, and thinking, right, that's just giving United the title, and then getting a draw at Old Trafford to sort of even it out. But again, those days, a defeat didn't mean as much then. You know, teams drop points all over the place. I mean, it's almost unthinkable now that a team would need a win on the last day of the season to get the title and not win, which was what Blackburn did. And then the team in second place just needed a win to go to win the league, which United did on that last day at West Ham, and not win either. So for the two teams needing a win on the final day and to not do it, it's just unthinkable these days. So
it would be like last season if City had not beaten Brighton and Liverpool had not beaten Wolves.
Yeah, that would never have happened. One of the teams was going to win. So although City won that day, yeah, it didn't feel... It was probably an important part of the title. At the time, was part of the influential on the title race, but it wasn't. But also, you know, City had to be careful. They were never too far away from being pulled into the relegation battle.
Yeah, they. The one thing that struck me from watching the highlights of that game as well, state of that pitch.
Yeah, I think it was for late in the season as well. It was a rat mess.
It was like it was a mud bath in the middle, and I honestly, it got me thinking. I can't remember the last time I saw a Premier League pitch like that. You know.
Yeah. Blackburn was always bad, but I think the other thing about that game, if you put it into context of United winning the title, is that I think City fans have always enjoyed going to Ewood Park because you get a fantastic away allocation. And you know, it's just down the road, so it's always full. It's always a good day out, that one.
Yeah. The kit as well, that black and white stripes with the grey mesh at the sides. What was that all about?
Horrendous. Absolutely awful.
It's not hard to get a City black and white, black and red kit right, is it? And here we are with that horrendous effort.
Yeah. And there's a couple of mullets on show as well. It's not a great era.
It's of its time, isn't it? Yeah. Let's say. Let's have a listen to the key moments from that Blackburn game. Here's commentary by Tony Gubbett.
Well, Coton's kick has gone straight to Shearer. It's a gift. And Tony Coton was the culprit. That's well delivered. Flowers is coming. The whistle's gone. Oh, it looks like he's given a penalty. Keith Cooper has awarded a penalty. But it's Keith Curl who's placed the ball on the spot, and Flowers to face a penalty. Half an hour gone. It's 1-1. Hendry, it's in. He does it again. The hero defender. And another one for Tony Coton to rue. Trying to pick out Quinn, Hendry's header down, Rossler, well placed, good goal. It's the first chance that he's had, and he's tucked it away with real aplomb. Now, got to get it back to Somerby. Here's Somerby, similar position from which he scored against Liverpool. It's saved, Walsh, it's in, City lead 3-2. Paul Walsh, that's for Rossler to run down, Rossler's free. Over the top of Flowers, up the bar! Oh, how close are they going to come? City have won. And Blackburn's grip on the Premiership isn't secure yet.
It's a crazy season. I mean, it keeps chopping and changing, but we probably still need one the way the results have gone over the last couple of days. What I'm pleased about today as well, the supporters have come tonight and witnessed a good game, and we've sent them home a little bit happier because we've let them down the second half of the season after being so good first half, you know. We're in the quarterfinals of the Coca-Cola, six, and then all of a sudden we've had a tremendous dip. But performances like that lift everyone, and that's a magnificent result for everyone at Man City.
You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast. You've made it this far, so don't give up now.
The other thing I remember about that was that penalty. I've had to rewatch that on YouTube, and I still don't know why it was given.
Why on earth? But I mean, you look at it as well. Look at the goals City conceded, both of them. Tony Coton. Yeah. What's he doing?
We can blame the pitch on that one. We'll let him off on that one.
Right, well, Brian Horton admitted his side had underperformed in the second half of that season. When he spoke to us, he reckoned that the final position of the team wasn't reflective of how well they'd played.
It wasn't just above the relegation zone. We were never in relegation trouble. So I don't want to hear that word, really, because we weren't. I think had we beat QPR on the last Saturday and we lost 1-0 to a poor goal, I think we'd have finished above halfway. As it happens, I think we dropped to 18, so it wasn't a relegation. It looked poor in the end, and we'd been better than that, because I think at Christmas we were sixth in the league, and obviously with the chairman that was in, he knew I was going, so he wouldn't give me any more money to buy players. So with the injuries, a couple of injuries I had, Tony Coton got injured. So it was almost inevitable, really, that the season would fall away. And that hurt me more than anything, because I didn't want to leave Man City that way, because we were better than that.
Hear all of our City interviews on our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
Now, John, they always say that the league table never lies. Were City better than the position showed that season, or is Horton maybe been a bit generous on his team?
Well, I mean, I don't always agree with that the table reflects, you know, what sort of a season you've had. You know, it can only be a one-point difference and things like that. So maybe it was slightly unfair. I think the other thing to recall in all this is you remember the big wins, you remember the big defeats, but just sort of going through the results of that season, there were a lot of games that just drifted away that were they were just comfortable away defeats where you never expected them to, you know. Do you know what I mean? They just sort of wins. They're away defeats that you just, there you go, that's another 2-0 defeat at wherever.
Yeah, 2-0 at West Ham, that sort of thing. Yeah.
So there were a lot of those.
It was during Horton's first season that Swales was ousted as chairman. Francis Lee came in. Did that have any effect on what was happening on the pitch?
I think there was a lot of off-the-field problems. There were people outside Main Road at full-time chanting for Swales out. And, there was a lot of excitement for Franny Lee because of everything that he was in terms of being a City legend. But also he was suggesting that he was going to put money into the club and put them back amongst the big boys. So it wasn't an easy time to be a manager. It did spill out over into the stands on occasions. There were chants of Swales and things like that. But so it wasn't easy for him though.
Yeah, I mean it's difficult to kind of judge because. On the one hand, you can say that Horton, that Francis Lee wanted to bring in his own man in Alan Ball, which he did at the start of the 95-96 season. But equally, he did give Horton a second season. So he got a fair crack of the whip at the job, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And he deserved a second season. No doubt about that. There was a lot to get excited about. There was good youngsters coming through the team then as well, don't forget. I think Gary Flitcroft is one of the best players that have come through the youth team that I've seen, and Edgehill was great then as well, and Lomas was coming through. There were a lot of good young players, and there was a lot of things to get excited about. It was still, although the finishes weren't great, 16th and 17th, like you say, it was still something worth going to watch, and there was some excitement about it.
Yeah, well, here is Brian Horton speaking about the decision to sack him. I asked him if he thought Francis Lee just wanted his own man in the dugout.
Yeah, absolutely. That's spot on. At the Christmas, I think we were sixth in the league around that time, and I think we were in the quarterfinal of the Coca-Cola Cup. I think it was Coca-Cola, whatever, and we lost to Crystal Palace to Wimbledon, wasn't it, I think? And Stevie Lomas broke his leg that day. It was a game where it was probably the worst draw we could get, and a game that we fancied winning, to be fair, and everything went wrong on that day. And then, so we went out of that. We'd beaten Newcastle away in the early round, and everybody thought it was going to be our year. But it wasn't, so you can sense it. I mean, I've been in football long enough to know when things like that are going to happen, and chairman won't give you any more money to buy players, then it's inevitable.
Please support the show by becoming a backer. patreon.com/bluemoonpodcast.
So, John, knowing that Lee did bring in Alan Ball, one of his best mates, do you agree with Horton's assessment there?
Yeah, I think it was coming. I think throughout it all, there was always a feeling that he wasn't Franny's man. And eventually that would happen.
How are the fans feeling about it, though?
Well, again, like all the sackings, I think there was a justification for it. We talk about those horrendous defeats. Certainly the cups were important, and that Palace defeat was painful. They lost at Cardiff in the FA Cup. There was another couple of bad defeats, and so I think there was still a feeling of who is this guy? He wasn't a superstar footballer. He's not a superstar manager. Let's try and get someone bigger.
Again, let's freshen it up like they'd done two years earlier. Let's freshen it up. The players weren't exactly happy, it seems. Here's Nicky Summerby speaking about the different managers he had at City, starting off with Brian Horton.
He wanted me to play as an out-and-out winger. We played 4-4-2, me and Peter Beagley on the both wing. Niall Quinn, Uwe Rosser up front, Paul Walsh was there as well. And that season, we actually created more chances than anyone else in the league, but the opposite side, we conceded a lot more. So on my side there was... I think he was probably the best of me. Alan Ball came in, he had his way, which he was a lot more aggressive with his approach, really. All the rest from Frank Clark, it was all right with Frank for a brief spell, but then all of a sudden he wanted Craig Russell, and that's when my time to move was. But all in all, it was Brian Orton, really. I'd like to have been given a little bit longer with Brian.
You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast. You've made it this far, so don't give up now.
And Uwe Rosler talking about what it was like after the manager had moved on.
I think it affected the club in terms of the following year we went relegated. I felt at the time, you always will have in the squad players who are very attached with the manager, and you have players who maybe not play as much as they think they should, and they are happy for a change because that open up doors again. So at that time I felt when Brian announced it, that was after the Blackburn game, I felt the general mood of the group was very, very low. It was a lot of players he signed at the time, and we felt we were just two or three players short in certain positions to maybe have a chance to finish top 10. So on another side, we also understood that it's football and the board or the chairman make decisions. We players, we have to respect. But the general mood from the group and also from myself, I was very low after Brian announced that after the game.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. But don't worry, it'll be over soon.
So, John, we can't ignore the fact that it was a disastrous start to the following season under Alan Ball. It eventually saw City relegated on the final day of the 95-96 season. They had... Was it 1 point from the first 10 games of the next season?
It was horrendous because I think everyone was sad that Brian went, but even those ones who thought it was probably the right decision, but when it was announced it was Alan Ball, that was a lot. You thought, oh my god, what have we got here? He had a bad reputation as a manager. He'd had one season with Southampton when he'd done okay, but other than that, he was awful. And there was a lot of worrying stories about that time. The one about him getting his World Cup medal out, saying, "Right, I've won that. You've won nothing." It sounds to me like a horrendous way to go into a club and try and get players on your side. They were dire. They were absolutely dire at that start of the season. I think the lowest point, although they didn't win any of those early games, was going to Liverpool in the League Cup and losing 4-0, and then playing Liverpool 3 days later and losing 6-0. You just thought,
10 goals in, yeah.
What has he learned from that game? I mean, I don't want to dwell on Alan Ball, but there were some great moments.
But we can.
There were great, he brought in Georgie Kinkladze, which was the only thing worth going to watch at times, but that was probably more luck than judgment.
Well, let's bring it back round to Brian Horton, because the one thing that I don't know if you find this surprising. I found this a bit surprising. Perhaps I'm wrong to find it like this, but Horton's win percentage at City was 30.2, and that's his lowest of anywhere in his career, apart from an 8-game spell he had back at Macclesfield in 2012. He'd done better at every other club on his win percentage than at City.
Yeah, but I don't think he ever had a bigger job than he did at City. I don't think he had another job in the top flight, so that's where it was toughest. But I think it was a lot to do with his philosophy. He went out to win games, not to draw games. So he got picked off.
Yeah, right. Well, we're going to finish with some audience questions. Richard Donlan asks on Instagram, why was there such a contrast between City's home and away form those years?
Again, I think it's probably the way they played, and that they were a little bit too open, and which you can get away with at Main Road when I think it was always a good atmosphere at Main Road. Then they were completely behind the team, and it was harder away from home. And I'm not sure they had quite the same fight as well away from home.
Yeah, Rob Pollard asks on Instagram as well. How much did Tony Coton's injury troubles hamper them?
Yeah, I mean, Coton was a great keeper and arguably the best keeper I've seen. He certainly would challenge Edison and Weaver and Joe Hart as one of the best keepers that I've seen at City. And Andy Dibble had a really, really tough time as when he became number one. I mean, I remember one game. I can't remember who it was against, but someone shot from outside the box and it rolled along the ground, and he just bent down to pick it up. And as he did so, it hit a bobble and hit him on the nose. And the whole kip actually started laughing. And I thought, oh, that's not a good position to be in when your own fans are... So Dibble had a tough time. Margaretson was not great. And then we were talking about the Horton era and that 5-0 defeat at United. Obviously, the goalkeeper that day was David?
Ike Immel?
No, it was Simon Tracy.
Simon Tracy.
Yeah.
Goodness me. Yeah. No, I'm interested.
I've ever seen.
And you've seen me play, so I mean, I'm going to take that as a compliment. I'm interested a little bit on Tony Cotton because I don't really remember him as one of City's keepers. This isn't long after the back pass rule had changed, so I'm guessing he played in an era pre back pass rule and post back pass rule. What was it like seeing goalkeepers adapt to that?
Yeah, it was really hard, particularly for the keepers who were of an age where they'd been doing it for a long time. And obviously that goal at Blackburn showed that Tony wasn't the best at it. It was a mess. I'm trying to think. I'm sure there was one incident where someone scored where someone like Steve Redman passed it back to him. No, would it have been Redman? I don't know. Someone passed it back to him anyway, and he picked it up, and there was an indirect free kick, and a goal came from it. It was probably entertaining, but it was...
Not in the right way.
Yeah.
Final question from Mike Cook on Twitter. He asks, do you think Francis Lee should have backed rather than sacked Horton? He got the team playing some excellent football. It just needed building on.
Well, yeah, I think he chose the wrong man to replace Horton, so that's the starting place you go off. So I would have rather had Horton carry on, and he was starting to build thing, and there were players coming through. It was sad to see Flitcroft go, for instance, before he was at his absolute best, because he was a great player. He was a great player for City. Same with Lomas, same with a couple of others. So they were starting to build things. You know, we talked a lot about Paul Walsh. Well, he was swapped for Jerry Craney, and I think that deal is infamous, isn't it, as possibly the worst deal ever in the club's history. So that certainly wouldn't have happened under Brian Horton. So they would have been... the difference in those two players is just absolutely ridiculous.
Extreme, isn't it? Yeah. Right. Well, that's it for this week's Blue Moon Podcast, Brian Horton special. Thank you very much to my guest, Goal.com's Jonathan Smith.
Pleasure, thank you.
Thanks to you for listening as well. If you'd like to leave us a rating and a review in all the usual places, it really will help us to attract some more listeners, and that helps us pay the bills through the advertisements, especially during this uncertain time. Don't forget also that you can listen to these lockdown specials in any order, so go back and check out some of our previous episodes. We've got plenty of topics covered, like Sven's only season in charge, every time City have broken their own transfer record, and the year that Kevin Keegan won promotion and entertained us all with Ayle Berkovic and Ali Benabia in the midfield. If you'd like to support the show, we're still making Patreon bonus shows each week too. This week's is a look at each of City's Premier League title wins and what it meant to both the club and the supporters. That's available for $2 a month, or about £1.63 in the UK. And for that amount, you'll get a minimum of 4 extra podcasts each month, all about 20 minutes in length, and there's more details on patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. That's it for this week. I'll be back next week. See you then.
Was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please support the show. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Cheers, mate. Thank you very much.
No worries. I need a cup of tea after that.